This is the Farming for a Better Climate podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Farming for a Better Climate podcast. My name is Seamus Murphy. I am a consultant with SAC Consulting in our environment team. And today I'm joined by agricultural consultant in the AIR office, Robert Ramsey. How are things, Robert?
Yeah, things are good, Seamus. Sun's shining in here just now. And it's good to be back in the office. I've been out on paternity leave for the last couple of weeks. And it's good to be, for a lot of reasons, it's been great to be at home. But it's also good to get back to a bit of normality as well.
Good stuff. So last month, we did talk a lot about carbon markets with Ben Law, a forestry consultant. Since then, have you heard much, or has there been anything kind of that piqued your interest after the conversation that we had with Ben?
Yeah, I really enjoyed our chat with Ben. It certainly opened my eyes to the other side of the picture, the forestry end of things. And I think it was quite nice, certainly, to hear a high-end forester really pretty passionate about farming and food production as well. So it was good to hear from Ben. The thing keeps rolling on, and as we said, we've said for long enough, this carbon market's not going away. Mm-hmm. It's changing, but it's not going away. And certainly there are farmers looking at all their, you know, all the opportunities they've got as well, and looking at their business as a whole, perhaps looking at small amounts of forestry here and there. And then also we do have these other guys who are getting, you know, significant offers for blocks of land and, you know, wondering where to go with it. So it's, interesting times. So we're trying to hit a moving target at the moment.
Yeah, it also seems to be kind of, there's two elements of it. There's a lot of kind of guys looking at measuring their emissions baseline and where they are at the moment and trying to reduce. And then also this kind of element of how they can make money from carbon credits. And it seems to be kind of, there's two bits to it all.
That pretty much is where our job is at the moment. You know, we're doing a lot of carbon audits and carbon discussions with people, and I really enjoy, and I've said it before but I make no apology of repeating it, but I really enjoy using the carbon audit as a business efficiency tool. So looking at the audit and then saying, look, your carbon percentage isn't good enough, or you're, you know, making better quality silage or whatever it is, what can we do to actually make significant improvements? And you mentioned baselining. There's probably, I would say, most commercial farms now have an understanding of where that baseline's at. Yeah. And having done that, they're mostly fairly keen to kick on and do another one and see if they're making progress or see where they're going. So interesting to see that, and also good to see Scottish Government backing the next round of carbon audits as well. So there's funding there to do it for anybody that's interested. But certainly that the other part, the entering the carbon market, there is the snake oil element to it as well, and there's the, you know, farmers that possibly have an opportunity that's big enough as make them maybe, you know, swallow their big opinions and swallow their thoughts on it and realise the value of their asset that they've got at the moment. So it's interesting times, but I think we have to, in all these conversations, go back to what Ben was saying. It's all about balance, and it's all about having the right tree in the right place, and equally the right sheep in the right place, and the right beef cow in the right place, and having that balance. And I do find what has changed since our last conversation is the UK government's stance on food production. So in the beginning of the year, they pulled all or started the process of getting rid of all area-based payments and basically getting rid of agricultural support. And then a few months later, we now have a really positive pro-food stance from DEFRA. So it's amazing. Whether that holds any water, that stance, I don't know. That's a different discussion. But interesting to see food back on the agenda alongside carbon, which is where it should always have been to start with.
Yeah. It's really interesting, all those different kind of elements to it. And today we're joined by John Farker, who is a senior consultant with SSE Consulting as well. And I'm hoping that John will be able to help us maybe better understand the market side of it, where the pressure is coming from there, and then also a bit more of a broader look at carbon markets and kind of the international elements there. So welcome to the podcast, John.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, it's great to be here again. It's sunny down south as well. Like everyone else in the agricultural sector, in the last couple of years, it's carbon this, carbon that. And I work kind of behind the farm gate, but I also work post farm gate, and the pressure, or the people in the rest of the supply chain, the processors and the supermarkets, retailers and wholesalers, they're all looking at, okay, especially around COP26 time, it was net zero. And anyone with any kind of reasonable knowledge of carbon and food kind of said, well, to get to net zero, we need to look at actual, not just reducing, that's first, and then there's these, we have to look at offsetting and sequestration. So that's the, I think, really hot up. So about 6 months or a year before COP26 is when everything went, okay, the net zero term became bandied around, and yeah, it's kind of, it seems to be one word, but as you said before, it's there's two aspects to it, and the one that you can be more easily paid for, I should say, and then the one that you probably want to do for your profit, and that's what Robert referred to as a business efficiency. If you reduce carbon as a rule, you'll increase your margin, and that's kind of what I guess as an organization we've kind of come from that background of, like, okay, we're looking at the increasing the efficiency of this production systems, and as a result, reducing carbon. And now I guess there's people approaching in the food sector, they're kind of seeing the land as where they can start to store carbon or offset carbon. And the supermarkets don't own land. The wholesalers don't own land, so they are looking down the supply chain at the landowners.
And I think on that one, John, the problem is when you get to, we have to face the fact that producing food emits carbon. You know, regardless of how we do it, there's going to be an emission. That's what, you know, respiration, we produce carbon dioxide all the time as well. How do we get to, are we ever going to get to a stage where food production is better than net zero? You know, I don't think we can do. And that's where there's the challenge of, we have to eat. And I don't want to sound too much like the old welly-wearing farmer that's always drumming that into us, but we do have to eat. And we've got the asset, as farmers, we've got the assets that other businesses are looking to exploit, really, to meet their net zero target. So I think we need to be cautious with how we place ourselves as an industry. But also, basically, I'm agreeing with you, John, it's time to take stock, work out where we are, and then start to make plans going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree. The there has to be a realization that net zero, with it depends what, within the globe, maybe, or within the world. But when you're looking at small boundaries, it all depends on that. It's like, okay, let's just do what we can and make sure to use not being ripped off. Because that, on the early stages of any market, you can be ripped off and you don't know the value of what you have. Mm-hmm. And in all fairness, I don't think any of us know the real value yet. We know sometimes when it's definitely not that. There are certain cases where it's been overvalued. People are planting trees on very valuable agricultural land, and you think, well, I can't, that doesn't make sense. It's a very expensive way of getting rid of carbon. But equally, you could be offered pennies for what's worth pounds. So yeah, it's that, know what you have. And also, there needs to be some kind of standardization and regulation. That's where we're at, I think. There is regulation, but a standardization, so you can when you're being offered or selling credits, you can compare the apples with apples, because it's very difficult to do that at the moment.
If we could take a step back for a minute and just kind of go back to the emissions reduction element of it. So I'm thinking kind of like the market forces that are trying to drive down emissions on farms. Why is there such a kind of an increased interest from, say, food producers, retailers, in the emissions associated with the farm? And then also, I suppose, what way is that going to go, or how can we predict what that's going to lead to in the future in terms of the impact that further up the supply chain will have on farms?
My start of a tenant is it comes from the net zero. So let's say a supermarket, they can reduce their emissions in their shops. Some of them put lots of renewables in. They can reduce the emissions on their transport, various means of doing that, and they are exploring that. In their shops, there's a lot of supermarkets running on renewables. They were kind of quite one of the early adopters after the kind of schools. So that's within their control. That's their own emissions, but they sell food. And once it basically, they have to go back up the chain to their processors and their wholesalers. And it's like, okay, but when they're selling the food, it's not just theirs. So of their food that you buy in the packet, probably less than 10% of that carbon comes from the shop itself. The rest is up the supply chain. It depends on the food. Some foods it's a lot higher, some foods it's a bit lower, but it's a big range. But they can only control a certain portion of it. So they look up the supply chain to get that product to zero or as low as they can get it. And it kind of, the first step is they go to their processors and producers. It's like, okay, so they're putting in renewable energy in their production plants. So in refrigeration, in processing, in cooking, anything that's got energy use, they're looking at that. There's not many of those. So that's quite easy. And then it's got to filter up because they realize they go into processors isn't, and their wholesalers and their suppliers isn't enough. They need to go up a stage. And that's where they're doing the discussions. They're forming the each supermarket does it differently, but they have a kind of a group of core farms they work with and the networks. And they are saying that we need to be looking at carbon and it is to meet their in-house targets of net zero in different timescales. But generally over the next 20 to 30 years, they're all aiming to be at net zero. Most of them are. So they need to act now.
Yeah. Okay. I think there was some big commitments made by them as well. And they get, so supermarkets are obviously very competitive. And if one does something, the next one will do that something times two or that something, but you know, they'll put a different shine on it. And there was one of them came out, I'm not mentioning any names because I think that would be inappropriate, but one of them came out and said they were going to reduce emissions by 80% by 2035, I think it was. And by the end of that week, they had all come out and said they were going to have net zero beef by 2030. And when they said they were going to reduce it by 80%, all the people like me who talk about beef all the time thought, how are we actually going to do that? How do you produce, you know, a carbon-based product without a carbon emission? And then it went, you know, it went crazy, and they all committed to have carbon neutral. And I don't know where there's a huge ambition, and I think we have to commend anyone with the ambition to do something about climate change. But in that case, there was a lot that was done based on saying the right thing to a consumer. And I strongly believe at the moment the worst thing we can do to our consumer is lie to them. And, you know, if we're going to be net zero, let's be net zero. But getting there is going to be, they've put so much pressure on themselves to do it. I suppose that's what free market economics is. If the market is interested in it, it'll get there quicker. But it was a huge commitment from them.
And how would that work? How would a retailer implement kind of change in the wider supply chain, particularly farms? Because I imagine, as John stated there, as you go further down that supply chain, it's going to get a lot more difficult because you're going to be dealing with a lot more actors. You're going to have a lot of farmers.
So there's a few good examples, and I think the one that my kind of go-to one would be the aligned dairy producers. So the dairy producers who have a Tesco contract or a Sainsbury's contract are accountable directly to the retailer. So they basically come in and, you know, each one is different, each contract's different, but they have targets and they have commitments that they have to make because they're contracted. So that certainly has driven a lot of progress in the dairy sector because the supply chain is relatively short. It goes farmer, processor, retailer, consumer. Where the challenge for me really sits is when you come into beef and sheep systems, where often the ownership, and certainly in a beef system, the ownership of the animal might have changed three times before it's slaughtered. Mm-hmm. So how do you actually, where do you pin that carbon to it? You know, how do you actually assess, and how do you assess it's one thing, but how do you actually drive improvement is another thing. Because as I say, those dairy guys, it's pretty easy. You pay them more. If they do a good job, you pay them more or continue that slightly better contract. If you are in a store cattle finishing type system, the supply chain is much more complex, and I can't really, in my head, I can't square that circle in a traditional beef and sheep type system.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an important point. Is also, you're looking at them in isolation with net zero. Again, we don't really define it. There are definitions, they're all fairly meaningless because people kind of think of it just generally on net zero for a beef product, but there, we kind of have to acknowledge in, let's say, a whole food supply chain for people in the, let's say, UK or Scotland, that we have to have, if we look at one thing, beef, okay, that's high carbon, bang, they get hit the beef. We might be acknowledging, okay, there is a limit to what beef can do, gets to, but to get to net is net zero. So someone else who can do more and get carbon negative offsets that. So you're right. So let's say in a hypothetical beef system, the people at the rearing stage, lower carbon. Go up towards the finishing stage, very high carbon. But again, it's everyone's responsibility. You can't say, oh, well, they're really good, the people are doing the rearing. It's not, because the end product is still, they've still got to be finished. Someone has to do that. So it's that, yeah, isolating it is nonsensical. We need to look at the whole thing, even wider than beef. Like, beef gets in there, but we've got to go, okay, we can get to what we can get to with beef. Right, let's say a low-carbon sector, veg, produce, they can actually get very negative. So it's in a whole. It has to be looked at, the net. Yeah. Some people might be high, but when you're looking on one product, it's hard. It puts pressure on people.
And without jumping back on the carbon credit soapbox, I do struggle with, so Scottish Farming PLC needs to do its bit for climate change. And I think, well, I know farmers are engaged in that. They want to do something. The challenge is when you take a beef farm, half of a beef farm, whatever it is, plant it, you then have an incentive to sell the carbon credits from it. And either way, what you do then doesn't actually contribute to a reduction of Scottish Beef PLC's carbon credentials. So we are doing things all the time that are improving the approach to net zero for farming, but the way we're counting it is probably, you know, we're helping other industries more than we're helping our own.
Yeah, but even I suppose this brings us nicely on to the next this second element that we wanted to talk about, because if we take, say, any kind of retailer then, and they engage with their supply chains, they go all the way down to the farmers, they get the farmer, and the farmer brings their emissions down to the best, they're the most efficient they can be, there's still going to be offsets required. And a lot of the market, not necessarily just in retail, but a lot of kind of companies are looking fondly towards agriculture, towards regenerative agriculture, soil carbon, all these different things to kind of as a means of obtaining carbon credits and then offsetting their emissions off the back of that. First of all, why do you think that there is kind of such an interest in soil carbon, regenerative agriculture, carbon credits? I know if you look at like Nestle or any of these big kind of corporations, they all talk about regenerative agriculture as being a huge kind of benefit to tackling climate change.
The regenerative stuff I'm really interested in, and I'm particularly interested in how we can apply some or a lot of these regenerative principles to pretty conventional systems. You know, regenerative agriculture is what historically we called good farming practice. You know, there's new ways of doing it. There's new ideas. There's new things coming through. It's called regenerative because in some parts of the world, in some parts of the UK, agriculture has been pretty detrimental to the natural environment. You know, we've been sore on soils, we've been sore on biodiversity conservation. The challenge I've got is we deal with a lot of dairy farmers who have been pushed into or in many cases very willing to go down the regenerative route. Regenerative agriculture is all about building soil carbon and or by building soil organic matter. Some of the soils we've got, you know, some of our clients with the highest organic matters are dairy farmers. Regenerative agriculture is a global fashion, it's a global trend, and we have to just be cautious that we make it fit our own systems rather than use a globally broad brush that takes systems that were designed to rebuild soils in Kansas to try and rebuild soils on an intensive dairy and oak tree. So there's, you know, it's horses for courses, but it's exciting, and it is exciting to hear, you know, it's positive agriculture. It's something, good farming practice, rewarding farmers for doing a good job and helping us better understand the whole soil carbon story.
Yeah.
I think one of the main reasons, it is a buzzword, that's definitely true, and it's been called various things for over its lifespan, but it's popular at a policy level and because it's cheap. Carbon, if we get to our carbon markets, you've got expensive carbon. So you've got things like capturing it from the air, those sorts of things, incredibly expensive to do, hundreds of pounds per ton. And then you kind of come down to planting trees, pretty expensive. You've got ply trees, you've got fencing, it's an expensive way of reducing carbon. Anything that improves efficiency, that's the cheapest. So because it's usually negative cost, because it's improving your margins. And then you've got this actually storing it, but maybe not having a detrimental effect on your production at fairly low cost, but it can be applied to a wide range of farming systems. So it's not niche. It's not like, so there's only a limited amount of farmland that can be planted with trees without being very expensive. However, there's a lot of crops and grass and grown all around. So it's got big scope. It's cheap as far as carbon goes, and it has positive and wider positive benefits beyond purely carbon. I think it's the government, for those three reasons, probably likes it. So from strategy, they like it, those three reasons. Commercial sector like it because it's cheap. And hence the corporations are pushing it as their big buzzword.
And I think as an industry, we've got the option there to jump on it and frame the whole. We do have a good chance here to tell a good story and do some good things while doing what we enjoy, doing what we've always done, and doing our bit for landscape community, you know, local economy.
And there is the whole element of the scientific basis for some of the stuff as well in terms of the carbon that's actually being sequestered. But I don't think we'll go into that in much detail today. But it is one of these, it should be said that it is one of these things that is debated quite vigorously.
I was going to make the very same point about the science has to back up the system. Otherwise, it'll fall on its face. If it doesn't, all that credit claimed over the, let's say, in the time, will be worth zero. And that's a very dangerous thing to get.
And the other credit that's worth pointing out is the very engaged young consumer backing UK agriculture is the biggest asset we've got. Yeah. We need to get them on board with what we are doing, and we need to be confident that what we're saying we're doing actually stacks up in 20 years' time, because we know shutting all the coal-fired power stations had a positive impact. We know that, you know, the renewable revolution, all that stuff is measurable. We can't do this on a whim. it has to be backed, it has to be correct, and we actually have to. I think if farmers mean it, if they're interested in it, and they want to change, the job is going to be absolutely fine. If we want to pretend that we're changing so that we can keep doing what we've always done, we've got a massive problem.
I think also just on that, going back to some of the stuff that Ben mentioned last week as well, it's all about making sure that we've got this robust mechanism like the peatland carbon code and the woodland carbon code in place that you can potentially sell credits from regenerative agricultural practices using this scientifically robust standard or mechanism that is there. And maybe that will be the soil carbon code that is likely to come out in the next year or so, or maybe it won't be. Maybe we won't ever get there with regenerative agriculture, but there are still loads of positives that can be taken from it from an agricultural perspective.
There's an interesting part, I suppose, looking forward to future subsidy and things. And the trouble with carbon credits is you make a reduction somewhere and then someone offsets, someone uses that to keep doing a bad thing. There's maybe a future in the subsidy system. Who knows where it's going? But could it be that we have a system where we get credit for what we're doing by way of a subsidy and don't have a credit that we can actually sell? And that means we have a reduction without, you know, it's a reduction without permitting somebody else to keep doing something else.
I mean, that is actually with the whole carbon trading thing, that there is usually within countries a credit to a company. They're not allowed to buy. So the few companies, there are very few companies, I should point out, that are regulated and have to reduce their carbon. You've got to be a very big company for that to happen. But the ones that do, they're not allowed to buy anything until they have proven to an independent auditor that they've done all the reduction they can. So again, it's that. But then you look at globally, lots of places that's not happening, but that would actually save that step. It's like, okay, we're going to take that as Scotland PLC. We'll take that. That's definitely a reduction. So it's what they call a UK inventory. That's, you do inventories for greenhouse gases on a country basis. They could take that, but you're right. You're not selling it over to, I don't know, Lufthansa and to fly and not do any kind of renewables in their fuels. That question's been debated for ages. It's like, is the carbon market just allowing people to do the same thing? And it's like, currently probably yes. In the future, I think it will be stopped.
Yeah, I think that's key to it all, essentially. If that's not kind of sorted, then what's the point in doing this? Because as you said, it just allows the continuation of the burning of fossil fuels. And essentially, that's what we need to stop. What is then, in, just in terms of going back to this hypothetical situation where we have a company that's looking down their supply chain, have reduced all their emissions, including on farm, have worked with farmers, and now they're looking to offset. What are the options in terms of the carbon credits that they can purchase to offset? So I know we've already spoken about the Woodland Carbon Code and the Peatland Carbon Code, but I'm sure we know that there are different systems and standards out there. What does it look like internationally, John?
There's a global framework for this, something called the RED, R-E-D-D, and it's changed and it's quite political. And it's a scheme whereby mostly tropical areas of forest, there are other schemes, but it's based around forest, protected or planted, mostly protected nowadays, and then any company, it's traded amongst countries, so usually it's between countries, so that started it, but it's now gone to commercial. So they use the same framework, and you get these schemes, and I can't spot one that's applying the principles and actually sends auditors out to check the trees are planted or it's not been cut down, whichever happens to be. I mean, these are some very remote places often in countries with not the best governance. I don't work in it a lot, if I'm honest. I used to kind of be involved slightly in the surveying of the woodlands, but it's to say it's a minefield is to say that it is an understatement. And there's different values. You can pay anything on these schemes from £25 a tonne for carbon up to 180. And the differences reflect the value. So if you're planting trees, that's expensive. To not cut them down, it's the food that's grown on it. That's what you pay for. And that's even more expensive. So, and then you've got to go into these areas and access them, and or even to establish trees on tropical soils that have been deforested. It's very hard to do, very expensive. So they have different costs, and that's the different values. But there's also the price reflects the social benefits and, yeah, and wider community benefits. It goes way beyond just the carbon. But to understand it, it's a very specialist thing, but it's hard for anyone as a company or an organization to kind of say, yes, I'm buying something that is good. I'm not saying it's all bad, but it's like, you can do it, but it's difficult because it doesn't appear to be that well regulated. Between countries, it is regulated, but that's an international system called RED. But when it's suddenly been selling it to Amazon or someone like that, or a company, it's as good as the person certifying it.
There are kind of standards out there, like the Gold Standard and Vera, that are internationally recognised. But again, I think they are the more expensive credits. So I suppose
they have a limited supply. They're also trying to buy them is very difficult. They can only produce so much. They do only sell what they've got.
Yeah.
So if that's run out, you have to go to another scheme. And that's difficult.
I suppose that's on us, though, isn't it, as the consumer, then, to make sure that we don't accept, if we are going to go down this road, and it looks like we are, where offsetting is going to be a necessity, and a necessity in a couple of ways. A necessity is in terms of sequestering carbon, because we do need to sequester a lot more carbon if we're going to achieve what we've agreed to under the Paris Agreement. So we do need to have these projects. We do need to plant more trees. We do need to reduce our emissions. We do need to fund these projects, and getting private finance for these projects is not necessarily a bad thing. But we need, as consumers, to make sure that when companies are offsetting, that the carbon credits they're buying are the most credible that they can be. And I suppose that's something that, when farmers are listening to this and they're considering whether or not to sell their asset that can be used to produce carbon credits, that they make sure that it's going to be that high quality, the best available, so that whoever is buying it is getting that premium credit, I suppose.
And they will receive the premium because of it. It helps them. But equally, I think it's kind of, I guess, the UK carbon market is young. But I think there will be a premium, like there is for produce, for UK carbon. UK-grown produce has a premium versus imported. Equally, investment, because you get the wider benefits within the community, the ecosystem, the natural capital benefits that come with most sequestration projects, they are here rather than halfway around the world. That's kind of it. So I think there is, if you can sell UK carbon to a company that's got a very big UK, so there's some supermarkets really do sell themselves on UK. So if they can buy their carbon here rather than from Malaysia or Indonesia, they will probably pay more for that, like they do the produce. So I think the Scottish farmers have to think, okay, if I'm selling to a UK for food production in the UK, and my carbon share, it has a premium because of that, I think it has to reflect it. But there's the costs are higher as well. If you want to plant a tree here, it costs more than planting in Malaysia.
I think one thing as well to keep really in the forefront of all our minds is inflation. You know, we hear about it all the time, but as farmers, we're sitting on, you know, a massively inflating asset, and that trajectory seems to be upward. You know, I think we're certainly, land is worth more this year than it was last year. We need to be very cautious. There's an opportunity for farmers to realize the value of an asset and do something different. So move money from one place to the other. But there's also the opportunity to take something that's inflating and make it into cash, put it in the bank and let inflation wither it away. So basically, I think at this point, it's hard because the last probably 20, 30 years, we've farmed away without really, you know, no massive inflation in the products we were selling. Some inflation in the stuff that, you know, the inputs, so the margins have been getting eroded and agricultural land has been gaining in value quietly. But we're now looking like we're heading into a high inflation, high interest, different world, back to where certainly our parents would be more the cautious generation were cautious for a reason. And I think all big changes like this at the moment need to be fully thought through and lots of good advice taken from, and that's not touting for trade, that's from whoever it is, but good financial advice to make sure that actually selling something for £8,000 or £10,000 an acre today isn't going to be worth £50,000 an acre in 5 years' time. So I think not wanting to end on a real negative, but I think we need to be very cautious with all these things, because at the end of the day, farmers have the asset that everyone else is needing. So make sure if you're going to get paid for it, you've got somewhere to go with it, and make sure whatever way you're trading or doing something, make sure that you and yours get as much as is physically possible out of what you're doing.
And equally, remember, you might need that carbon yourself at some point. Once you've sold it, it's gone.
Yeah.
I think that's a good place to finish up. Thanks, Robert, and thanks, John, for coming on. For more information on everything we spoke about today, please visit the Farming for a Better Climate website. If you want to hear more about carbon markets, you can listen to the previous podcast where we spoke to forestry consultant Ben Law about the basics of carbon credits and carbon markets. And we will be talking more about carbon markets in the next episode of this podcast series. Thanks everyone for listening. Bye then.